Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Christy Rosa. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Phoenix, Arizona for a State of the Science Summit on genitourinary cancers. At the meeting, faculty from Mayo Clinic and Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center highlighted how novel agents have revolutionized the non-metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer paradigm and explained how the profound data could lead to the first PARP inhibitor approval in metastatic castration-resistant disease. Moreover, faculty shed light on how researchers are refining the role of next-generation imaging in prostate cancer and spotlighted the novel approaches that have moved the needle forward in metastatic urothelial cancer. Additionally, faculty explained how the frontline setting in metastatic renal cell carcinoma continues to evolve with combination regimens and discussed the patient selection required for cytoreductive nephrectomy in metastatic renal cell carcinoma. We kicked off the night with Chair Alan H. Bryce, MD, who is an assistant professor of medicine and chair of the Division of Hematology Oncology in the Department of Internal Medicine at Mayo Clinic. Over the past 2 years, FDA approvals of three oral antiandrogen agents have transformed the non-metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer treatment paradigm, according to Bryce. Moreover, on the heels of the Phase 3 PROFOUND trial data, interest continues to peak regarding PARP inhibitors for men with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. In our interview, Bryce explained how antiandrogens have impacted the non-metastatic castration-resistant space and discussed encouraging updates as well as emerging strategies in the metastatic setting.
In the last year, non-metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer has really become a disease entity that physicians are much more aware of due to the approval of three drugs for the treatment of this. This is a disease state where patients have yet to develop visible metastases on imaging studies, but the PSA is rising despite being on ADT. And when that's happening, we know that the patient is generally going to progress to metastatic disease within the next 12 to 18 months. So now we have three drugs that have been approved for use in this space, and they're all antiandrogens, so oral therapies. Fairly well tolerated, and the three drugs are apalutamide, darolutamide, and enzalutamide. All three were subject to randomized controlled trials where they were randomized for ADT with apalutamide or enzalutamide or darolutamide versus placebo. And the endpoint here was metastasis-free survival, which was a new endpoint for prostate cancer and probably one of the other key points to note that this is now a recognized endpoint for the biochemically recurrent space. And importantly, all three drugs showed a meaningful delay to metastasis, metastasis being the key point at which patients really start to suffer deterioration, and ultimately progressing to death, because it's the metastatic patients that aren't going to be cured and are going to die of their prostate cancer. So in the metastatic setting, there's still a lot of progress being made in prostate cancer. Still an exciting time. Happily, the pace of change has not slowed down. Right now, the PARP inhibitors have seen the first of the Phase 3 studies read out. That was presented by Maha Hussain at ESMO. And olaparib has shown to be effective in DNA damage response mutant prostate cancer, with improvements in progression-free survival and overall survival when randomized against an androgen pathway inhibitor. Certainly, I think based on the data, we are hopeful that this will receive FDA approval in the U.S. sometime in the not-too-distant future. The study of PSMA lutetium has completed accrual. We don't really know when we expect to see some results on that, but hopefully by late 2020, we'll see some outcomes in terms of overall survival. Certainly, the early data from Australia and from Germany was very promising, so we're all looking forward to that. Other PARP inhibitors in the pipeline, including rucaparib and niraparib, are continuing to accrue. So, I'm very hopeful that we're going to see a space where we have multiple approved PARP inhibitors And hopefully, you know, some distinguishing characteristics between them to allow the clinician and patient to have some choice in terms of what treatment. Other radiopharmaceuticals are certainly being developed. After lutetium, you know, actinium is being developed as well, thorium, so other isotopes, mostly again complex with PSMA as the delivery vehicle. Immunotherapy, we're starting to see some more activity. Some bispecific antibodies in development, which certainly are interesting, but we'll have to see how those play out before we can say anything. You know, finally, we've had definitive, hopefully, debate settling proof of cabazitaxel versus the androgen pathway inhibitors. I think from a scientific perspective, no one should be surprised that cabazitaxel is better than using the second oral androgen pathway inhibitor, that is abiraterone or enzalutamide, after one has used the first docetaxel. I think we all expected that, but there was enough clinical equipoise, I would say, from practitioners choosing to use the oral drugs before chemo, that we needed a trial to prove the point, and it showed, I think, what we all expected, which is chemo is better, right? There's a lot of cross resistance between the oral drugs. Once you use one, you don't really get a lot of mileage out of the second. So at least in terms of providing definitive data to give people confidence, I think we've really settled that point, and now people can really look at that study and have confidence that chemo is the right answer.
Next, we sat down with Philip J. Koo, MD, who told us that 18F fluciclovine and gallium 68 prostate-specific membrane antigen-based PET imaging modalities have better sensitivity, specificity, and accuracy in detecting recurrent prostate cancer compared with conventional imaging tools. Listen on to hear Koo, Division Chief of Diagnostic Imaging at Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center, discuss the use of conventional imaging as well as the next generation imaging tools that have the potential to change the management of patients with recurrent prostate cancer.
Next generation imaging is something that the community has asked for decades. Our conventional imaging tools have focused on bone scan and CT, but we've always known that there were a lot of lesions that we're probably missing. And that really is important because when you're looking at salvage therapies or potential interventions that might cure a patient, you really want to know for sure whether or not that disease is metastatic and where it might be confined to, so that any intervention might potentially lead to a cure or some sort of durable outcome. One next generation imaging tool that is most widely available and best performing currently is fluciclovine, F18 fluciclovine, which goes by the trade name of Axumin. The performance thus far has been shown to be as good, if not maybe a little better, than C11 choline, which was the first novel radiopharmaceutical PET agent that was approved in the United States. Currently with fluciclovine or Axumin, it is widely available in the United States. I believe at last count it might have been over 300 sites in the United States. That being said, when we really look at the future of what next generation imaging is going to look like, it's really going to be focused on PSMA-based imaging agents. And the use of these agents varies across the globe. In the United States, we do not have any FDA-approved PSMA PET agent. That being said, there are several sites in the United States that are offering these under NDAs or clinical trials. But once there is FDA approval for either the generic gallium 68 PSMA or the commercialized versions of PSMA, we'll see greater availability across the United States. It's very easy to fall in love with these great imaging tools and these advances in technology. But I think the one thing that we all need to remember is 99% or greater than 99% of all the clinical trials have been based on conventional imaging, the bone scan and CT. So that's where we have the data. So I think at this point, it's a little premature to say that we will no longer need conventional imaging moving forward. That being said, knowing that next generation imaging tools provide us with more accurate data, it's safe to make the assumption that better and more accurate imaging tools will help us unlock the key, or have the key to unlock better improvements in outcomes in the future. So that's why I think if we look way deeper into the future, yes, I think conventional imaging might have a smaller role as we move forward.
Next, we spoke with Parminder Singh, MD, a hematologist and oncologist at Mayo Clinic. Data with a slew of targeted agents have shown a significant improvement in response rates in patients with metastatic urothelial cancer, explained Singh. And interim data from the Phase 3 IMvigor130 trial have the potential to show survival gains as well. In our interview, Singh provided perspective on the IMvigor130 trial results and discussed the number of targeted therapies that have emerged for patients with metastatic urothelial cancer who progress on standard therapy.
The first one were a series of drugs which are in immune therapy based drugs. They are immune checkpoint inhibitors. They were approved, five of them got approved simultaneously in the same year. And then recently we have the FGFR3 inhibitor, erdafitinib, which was approved. Traditionally, patients who had progressed on chemotherapy, the median survival had been in the range of 6 to 8 months. Since the approval of these agents, we are seeing responses with immunotherapy, especially the overall response rate, however, in the range of 15 to 20%, but the patients who are responding, up to 70 or 80% of them have responses which are ongoing up to 12 months, which was a dramatic change in the treatment paradigm for urothelial carcinoma and showed quite a good promise. And these numbers were even higher in patients who were expressing PD-L1. With the recent approval of erdafitinib, what we are seeing is over 40% patients who had prior immunotherapy and or chemotherapy are responding, and the median survival has gone up to 11 to 12 months, which is a big change for this disease. However, the number of patients who are FGFR3 mutated are low, so the catered population is very limited. IMvigor130, which was presented at ESMO, which met its primary endpoint of progression-free survival benefit versus chemotherapy alone, which the overall survival data is pending as the interim analysis was presented and the enough events had not occurred. But if that trial shows that overall survival also hold ground as proposed in the trial design, then the first-line treatment options for metastatic disease may change and will lead to a complete change in the treatment paradigm of urothelial carcinoma. It's true that the two-month approval improvement is not something which could have a clinically meaningful benefit, but at the same time, if the overall survival meets the pre-specified endpoint, then it would still be approved, and then the treatment paradigm may change. It is to be seen how the PD-L1 high versus PD-L1 low patients perform on that clinical trial. So there are a lot of things which are coming on that trial, which I'm sure will have some impact on how we treat patients upfront with chemotherapy. And I'm very hopeful that immunotherapy will find its space in first line combined with chemotherapy, either a traditional chemotherapy like GemCis or GemCarbo, or maybe newer drugs like enfortumumab.
When Carlos E. Vargas, MD, a radiation oncologist at Mayo Clinic, stopped by, he discussed the role of radiation in prostate cancer, spotlighting a number of approaches and the toxicities associated with each. Listen on to hear more.
In the definitive setting, the main advantage of SBRT is that we have three randomized trials now showing that SBRT has similar toxicity profile than standard fractional radiation therapy. The advantage really there is that patients can be treated over five treatments instead of having to come for treatment for somewhere between 6 to 8 weeks or sometimes even more. So given that the results are similar for both treatments, there are significant gains for the patient in terms of time saved for the patient, time that the patient stays at home. It reduces cost of care and improves access to care. So those are mainly the advantage for in that setting. In the after surgery for high-risk features, the advantage is similar. The third part is the role of SBRT in patients with oligometastatic disease, which is something that is really emerging. We have data from four randomized trials now. We have two trials where they are only testing SBRT without any systemic therapy, and they are showing that radiation therapy will delay the progression of the disease. We also have data of radiation therapy with systemic therapy showing that radiation therapy will improve median survival for about a year. And we also have data where we only treat the primary, and we even forgetting about the oligometastatic disease, just treating the primary with systemic therapy at the same time in patients with oligometastatic disease, that just treating the primary will actually improve also the median survival of these patients. Right now, the standard is fractionated therapy, and it's kind of interesting to see that we have moved very fast in the oligometastatic setting and in the definitive setting for SBRT, but we have really forgotten about patients after surgery. There were some technical challenges to treat a cavity, a virtual area, instead of treating a target in terms of localization, guidance, and things like that. But to be honest, those are technical issues that can be solvable. But the toxicities so far have been similar for standard fractionated radiation therapy and for SBRT. The main toxicities are really related to the inflammation that the radiation produces during the treatment, and that related to increased frequency with urination. There's also increased bleeding that is going to be seen in the stool or with the urine. And really the key part for this is to understand that this is an inflammatory process, that patients will get better over time, that there's really no need to try to do invasive procedures that actually in the long term don't prove to be as effective. So usually it's just do medical management for these patients, anti-inflammatory agents, sometimes steroids, decrease the frequency of their urination, increase the frequency of the bowel movements if the patient's having a rectal bleeding or pain. And over time, the patients get better and all this heals. Usually we see a first wave during the radiation therapy and shortly after, and then usually we see a second wave of inflammation that starts happening about 6 months after we complete the radiation therapy, or start all the way up to about a year. And these patients will have intermittent inflammatory symptoms, and usually after a year, year and a half, they start to get fewer and fewer, and usually past 2 years, patients are completely healed and they don't have any more symptoms from the radiation therapy. So usually it's just being more conservative about the treatment, not trying to be invasive, understand that this is going to get better in the majority of cases. And there are multiple strategies from, as I was saying, steroidal agents, steroids, medications to decrease the frequency or in the urination or bowel movements. There's also hyperbaric oxygen that can be used. So there are multiple strategies to increase and improve the healing. Regarding preventive strategies, to be honest, there's really not much that we can do. The only preventive strategy that we can have is to try to treat the target as tight as we can, do very good image guidance, have very tight margins around the target. And that's really based on having a good group of physicists, good planning, a very strict QA, so that actually you can have very, very conformal treatments. Because if we can treat the area and minimize the dose to normal structures, the risk of having complications is lower. But to be honest, besides that, there's really no preventive thing that you can do. There's no medication or change in diet that patients can do to prevent these complications from radiation.
The FDA approvals of dual immunotherapy and TKI immunotherapy combinations for use in patients with newly diagnosed metastatic renal cell carcinoma have signaled a shift away from TKI monotherapy in the frontline setting, according to Tai H. Ho, MD, PhD. Listen on to hear Ho, who is a consultant in the Division of Hematology Oncology in the Department of Internal Medicine and Assistant Professor of Medicine at Mayo Clinic, discuss frontline treatment considerations in metastatic renal cell carcinoma, the utility of TKI monotherapy, and new combinations on the horizon.
There's two major schools of thought. One school of thought is to stratify the patients into poor, intermediate, as well as favorable risk, those that have poor and intermediate risk. If you're going for a higher complete response rate, you would go for the Yervoy-Opdivo combination. The advantage of this is a pure IO combination, complete response rates of 10%. This is independent of PD-L1 status. Another school of thought is to not even use the IMDC risk group and essentially give axitinib and pembrolizumab to all comers. So this essentially allows you to not worry about the IMDC risk group. This is associated with lower incidence of grade 3-4 adverse events. And then you also have a higher objective response rate. So between those two combinations, I think those are the most favorable in terms of results with regards to overall survival and progression-free survival. And there is a role for TKI monotherapy, particularly from the CABO-SUN data. With the CABO-SUN data, this is a phase 2 alliance study in which patients were randomized to either cabozantinib or sunitinib. I think the upshot of all these four trials, phase 3 and phase 2 is that sunitinib has been beaten by multiple agents now, so first line therapy should not include sunitinib unless you have some other compelling reason. With the CABOSUNS data, you had an improved progression-free survival and overall survival with cabozantinib when compared to sunitinib, and this might be an option for patients who are IO intolerant or IO ineligible. For me, I prefer to go for a higher complete response rate that also preserves the use of cabozantinib in the second line in terms of anti-angiogenic therapy. We don't have any good data in terms of sequencing information yet, but my feeling is that I would rather go use the drug compound that has the highest complete response rate at 10% and then use cabozantinib in the second line.
We closed out the night with Eric P. Castle, MD, a professor of urology at Mayo Clinic, who said that the metastatic renal cell carcinoma paradigm has evolved with a multitude of systemic therapies and pivotal data in recent years, challenging the role of cytoreductive nephrectomy. However, he added, the approach can still be utilized in select patients. In our interview, Castle discussed the role of cytoreductive nephrectomy in RCC based on interpretation of the Carmina trial results. Listen on to hear more.
Carmina was a trial where they randomized patients to receive sunitinib alone versus surgery or cytoreductive nephrectomy followed by sunitinib. And what they found was it was non-inferior to the outcomes. The problem with the trial was that one can make the argument that monotherapy with sunitinib isn't really the standard of care anymore because we're using other drug combinations that my colleague Dr. Ho had touched on. Furthermore, when we look at the trial very closely, they had quite a few high-risk patients, and in fact the surgery arm had more high-risk patients than the sunitinib alone arm, which would indicate that a lot of patients that would normally benefit from cytoreductive nephrectomy were probably not included in this trial, and it probably does not reflect all the patients, so you can't really group them all together. What we do know, however, is that this trial does highlight the fact that there are patients who really aren't going to benefit from surgery and that everybody should not proceed with a cytoreductive nephrectomy. In many cases, we kind of knew that. The patients that are referred to me by my medical oncology colleagues for cytoreductive nephrectomy often have good performance status, or from a risk stratification standpoint, they're good to intermediate risk, or in some cases, it's for palliation, because even relieving those symptoms from the locally advanced disease can be pretty beneficial for patients. So some people have looked at a variety of different prognostic models. Probably the most consistently used one is the Memorial Sloan Kettering stratification for renal cell carcinoma, as well as a variety of other things. People have looked at LDH, calcium, different white cell ratios, sarcomatoid features, a variety of different things that can be used to help make a decision about whether the patient's going to benefit from surgery. But overall, it's a patient that has some metastatic disease, or particularly oligometastatic disease, that you might even be able to perform metastasectomy concomitantly, because we know that there's very good data that those patients actually do very well. And they kind of present themselves there. It's almost like they select themselves out, and then they can be treated with therapy later. It's the patient that kind of comes in with multiple metastases, both including liver, bone, maybe aren't going to do well with surgery at all to begin with. Their labs are way outside the norm. All of those things, you might be steering that patient towards systemic therapy first, and if they do okay, then you might consider some sort of cytoreductive or some kind of consolidation surgery later. Technically, you can't apply Carmina in this era with the drugs that are primarily being used now. But what, again, it kind of gives us is an idea that there are patients who would benefit from just systemic therapy first. Because what we have seen, even with other trials that have looked at cytoreductive nephrectomy, either deferred or prior to systemic therapy, is that the patients who get systemic therapy first are more likely to get that therapy. So kind of looking through the patients and figuring out who's going to be best served with surgery is probably what most of us are taking away from Carmina. And lastly, we got to remember that the surgical era today is very different than it was 10, 15 years ago. A cytoreductive nephrectomy many times included a very large, either chevron, flank, subcostal, or midline incision, where in many cases, even the patients that are being sent to me, even if they have vena cava thrombus, we are doing these surgeries minimally invasively, where they're actually being discharged the very next day. So the delay in getting to that, you know, so desperately needed systemic therapy is a lot shorter than it used to be. So again, I think the Carmina gives us some insight that we need to be selective about who we're going to be offering surgery to, but at the same time, I don't think cytoreductive nephrectomy is dead at this time.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to learn more about the treatment of breast cancer, consider registering for the February 4th State of the Science Summit in McLean, Virginia. We also will be holding a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal malignancies on February 5th in New York City, New York. Register now at onclive.com/meeting/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.